This is an oral history project of the Appellate Practice Section of the Florida Bar. Through interviews with members, we hope to record and preserve the history of the Appellate Practice Section. Here is your host, Dwayne Diker.
In this installment of the APS Oral History Project, I'm joined by appellate specialist and former clerk of the Florida Supreme Court, Tom Hall. Tom played a very important part in the early history of the section and served as the 12th chair in the 2005 to 2006 bar year. Tom, thanks for joining me to help preserve some of the section's history by talking with the folks who were actually there.
Well, thank you. It's my pleasure. Enjoy doing it.
I have to tell you, from my perspective, you are a staple of the APS. I have very few memories of APS events that don't involve you in some way. You are actually the first chair that I personally remember from my early days in the section. And I know that you, in the previous episode, we talked with Tony Musto about some of the earliest days of the section. But so what were the early meetings like back in that time? How many people would show up to the meetings? What was sort of the atmosphere in those early days that you were involved?
There weren't a lot of people who showed up to the meetings, but the attitude was what virtually everybody who involved at that time was, whatever I can do to make this work and whatever thing you need done or whatever position you need filled or any of that sort of thing. That's everybody had that attitude. I remember Cindy Hoffman especially volunteering to do all kinds of stuff that needed done. And I think she was on the first board. Roy Wasson, of course, was really active, and other people, but there weren't that many people who showed up to the meetings. And I think part of that was, man, I was included in this. None of us had really belonged to that group, had not belonged to sections before, because there was no appellate section. I was very interested at that time because I worked at the First District Court of Appeal. I was really interested in the government lawyer section that was forming, because at that point especially, they were really bringing to light that there were a lot of government lawyers and were not getting, and were being treated differently than a lot of other lawyers within the bar even. So I was interested in that, but I wasn't a member of that yet. I don't think they were quite formed. So everybody who was there was very active and very interested in doing whatever they could to help.
And was there any particular reason why you became chair when you did? Was there were you asked to do that, or is this something that you were working towards?
It was one of those things. My wife and I joke about this all the time, that I join new groups all the time and promise her I'm not going to do anything other than just go to the meetings as a member. And then suddenly I find myself in charge. So I think this was one of those that I was going to be a member and I wanted to see what it was. I wasn't practicing at the time. I was practicing as representing the court in some things, but I was really working at the court and worried about court administration and helping that whole process. So I just got involved because I did see that there was a need and I thought there were things we could do. And because I worked at one of the appellate courts, we could interact with the courts better than we were in the beginning. We didn't have judges when we first started.
So I think in looking at the prior chairs, like I said, this is a little bit before my time in the section. I'm assuming that you were the first chair who was not a lawyer in private practice.
I think that's true. I hadn't thought about it before, but I'm pretty sure that is true.
So do you think, was there not an issue? Was there any concerns about that, about you being a court employee as opposed to a practitioner and serving as the chair?
I don't, among the section, I don't think so. If there was, nobody told me. I certainly discussed it with the court before whoever the chief judge was then, because I thought there could be issues the other way, that the section might be lobbying for things or taking positions in cases, those sorts of things. When I was at the First District, I stayed as long as I worked there. I stayed on the appellate Court Rules Committee, because like I said, there weren't term limits. But then when I became clerk of the Supreme Court, the court asked me to get off of the Rules Committee for that exact reason, that there'd be rules coming before the court and I'd worked on them and all that sort of stuff. And so I stepped down at that point. You know, I never saw it as an issue. And I did want to get the courts more involved in the section. I know a couple of times I was really hoping we could create like a bench bar sort of thing that would happen once a year where we would get, you know, a certain number of lawyers and a certain number of the appellate judges together and just have this informal retreat like thing. It never got off the ground. Now, eventually we ended up having the thing where we got invited to the DCA conference.
I know that one of the things that you're particularly proud of is the section producing the pro se handbook. So could you talk a little bit about your involvement in getting that to come to life?
Yeah, I'd been to a national conference of appellate staff attorneys, people who worked for courts. And I had seen these samples of appellate handbook, you know, pro se handbooks. And they were, they looked good, but they were, I was struck by, they were all pretty short. And not all that comprehensive. And mostly, my recollection is mostly they were developed by the courts that were handing them out. And they, you know, they were purposely careful about not getting into a, they wanted to be helpful, but not too helpful because the court can't give advice. You know, there's a wonderful opinion by Judge Larry Smith from the first DCA, which I haven't looked up in a long time, but he really explains how if you're self-represented, the court would like to help you but can't, because the court is supposed to be neutral. And if they start helping the self-represented litigant, they are seen as not being neutral. And he wrote a wonderful opinion explaining that. And if you know Judge Larry Smith, he was just a great guy and could really put stuff in language that everybody, including the self-represented litigants, could understand. He wrote that great opinion. But I just thought that there could be a better one. So I came back from some meeting and I think I was maybe on publications then, I can't recall. But I just came back the next meeting and a thing said, you know, we ought to look at this and put this together. We're the experts on appellate practice. We should be able to do something. And so we started putting it together, and we had, and I was sort of, they appointed, I think, a special committee, and I was sort of chairing the committee. And we were just at that point, we were just trying to get, you know, what goes in it? What can we say? What areas of the law? Is it going to cover every area of the law or just certain areas? You know, we were trying to get all that going. And it sort of went along for a couple of years, and we had a lot of people contributing, and there was issues about what level of language it should be, all of that stuff. Because I then took some other position in the section, I can't remember what, Dorothy Easley volunteered to take over the pro se handbook. I still like to call it the self-represented handbook, but I got outvoted on that. She took it over. And Dorothy, if you know, she, one of her big issues that she's always been involved in is plain English for like jury instructions and things that the court tells people when they're talking to juries or just the people in there, or even the defendants or the litigants who are in the court with their attorney, that sort of stuff. She's been very interested in that. And so she took it and really ran with it and really turned it around and made it work and got it in. I remember working with her. We did a lot of research about what would be the age appropriate level. And we started off with eighth grade, and we ended up with fifth grade based upon some research that we did and found that that was the real level you wanted to shoot at. So you'd get so self-represented people would get a good understanding.
You know, that's interesting, because I've worked on parts of the handbook over the years and never really thought about that. That is an interesting issue that, you know, had to be confronted first.
Yeah.
Do you think your involvement with the court spurred this in part, seeing the difficulties that the court was having in dealing with pro se appellants?
Yeah, and appellees, but I was at the first, and they handled all the workers' comp cases. A lot of those workers' comp cases ended up being self-represented, and it was, you know, it was really difficult for a self-represented person to really understand the workers' comp system. It's complicated as can be. And every year when the law changes, the law that was in effect on the time of the accident applies. So, and back then the comp law changed quite a bit every year. So it was really, really difficult for self-represented litigants to try to do themselves. In addition, until I went back to working for a court, because I had law clerk for Judge Dan Pearson at the third, I forgot how many cases at the appellate level really are pro se. I think at the first, when I worked there, something like 80% of family law cases, at least one side, was pro se. And of course, all the prisoner appeals are, the post-conviction ones are, well, 99% are pro se.
In doing some of the research for this oral history project, I came across some notes that suggested that the sort of announcement that the section was going to do a pro se handbook was in the summer of 2002, and that the actual handbook wasn't first published until January 2008. Does that sound right to you?
Yeah, it really turned out to be a much harder thing to do than we thought it was. And it kept expanding. We kept adding areas of law to it. And I think it still expands. You know, I can remember a couple of years ago sending somebody, whoever the head of was that year, saying, hey, there's this new case that comes out. Boy, it really changes everything in some area of the law. And they started looking at it. Well, yeah, we got into. I think they added a whole new chapter. I can't remember what it was about, but it was totally different than what it had been before.
I definitely think the pro se handbook stands out as one of the sections, just, you know, sort of biggest undertakings, and one of those things we always want to have some effect, you know, outside of the section, and that certainly has had that effect. And it's a huge project. It's always been a huge project, and it continues to be, but boy, it has a huge impact from everything I understand about it.
Yeah. And one of the things that we were very successful, and I certainly don't claim any kind of credit for this, was getting to get it accepted in the prisons, that we could send it there, to get it then to get the appellate courts to put a link to it on their websites when they really got more aggressive about websites, so that it was readily available to people. And we got money from the bar. I think the first time we did it, we got money to translate it into Spanish and Creole, which was a big deal as well.
Right. And I remember there were debates about how many languages and which languages to translate it into.
Right. Yeah. And in fact, one of the issues that we talked about at some point was I found out that the second DCA had a large contingent of people who were Vietnamese, and Vietnamese was their native language, and they wanted it translated. And we ultimately determined there weren't enough to warrant that expense. But it's amazing how many languages people speak in Florida, and English is their second language.
And can you imagine what a relief and what a resource that is to people who, you know, who don't speak English and are trying to wade, you know, it's tough enough to wade through the court system if you speak English and speak English at a high level, no less to try and translate that yourself. I just, that's quite a accomplishment and quite a benefit that the section has provided.
Yeah, it turned out once we decided we wanted to do it in different languages, we got a lot of help from the big bar on that, and you know, other people really helped us on that and make that happen.
Another one of the section's sort of flagship things that we have done over the years is, of course, we've done a lot of CLE offerings, but the Appellate Practice Workshop. This was actually one of my early experiences with the section, as I attended the Appellate Practice Workshop. When I attended it, it was at Florida Coastal, and this was a multi-day experience where you would write a brief that would get, you know, reviewed and critiqued by appellate lawyers and also appellate judges. And then you would also have an oral argument that the same things would happen. It was just it was a fantastic experience for me as a young appellate lawyer, and just another great undertaking by the section. Can you talk a little bit about how that started?
Yeah, I had been at some point, I had gone to a program put on by the NITA, National Institute of Trial Advocacy, I think that is. They put on a trial program like that, where you go for a week and you have a couple of cases and you get assigned a partner and you work with them and you do, you know, you put on witnesses and you get evidence admitted and you make arguments. And it was that. And so I went to that, and then I don't remember exactly when this was, but I was at an executive committee meeting, and I don't think I was on the board yet. I know I wasn't. And I just made a suggestion that we ought to look into something similar for appellate. We could have people write a brief, and we could have mock oral arguments, and we could do the same sort of thing. We could, in essence, create a big moot court problem and have people deal with it and do what they do and have multiple chances and have a chance to get feedback from judges about how they performed and all that sort of stuff. So I made the suggestion, and the board said, yeah, we'll look into it. And then as soon as the meeting was over, Judge Peter Webster at the first came over to me and said, I'd really like to work on this. You know, if you're willing to, the two of us can volunteer and we can try to make this thing happen. So I said, yeah, that sounds great. And so he said, I think I can get other, you know, candidly really good appellate judges to commit, and ones that have teaching experience too. And if we can get them to commit, I think then it'll draw a lot of lawyers to come to the program when they see who the judges are going to be and who's doing the instructing and all that. So he and I worked together, and he mostly, you know, he made the connection with the judges. One of the first people we went to was Bill Van Nortrick, who was at the first, and we got him involved, and he took a great interest in it. And then we just went from there, and then we were trying to figure out some other stuff, and I knew this guy, Jan Majewski. He was the director of CLE for Stetson, you know, law school. And he and I had served on the bar CLE committee together and had gotten to know each other really well. And they were really active at the time about putting CLE on for lawyers around the state. You know, they were using their professors to do continuing legal education for lawyers. It was a regular, great ongoing program that they had. And so I said something to him about, would Stetson maybe want to be involved, because I had been to their campus and I knew they had a great facility. And he jumped on it and said, yes, we would absolutely. He went back to their dean, and their dean said, yes, let's get involved. The only thing they wanted was they wanted at least one of their law professors to be involved and help plan, which we did. And so we put the first one together, and we had Judge Martha Warner, Chris Altenburn. I know I'm going to forget a bunch, but we really had a really great set of judges who participated. And I remember that I helped and Peter helped, and we wrote a problem, but we also got, so we got like Sylvia Walbolt came in and did a mock oral argument of a real case that she had argued against whoever was on the other side with her. They re-argued the case as to show how it was done. Larry Klein and Chris Altenberg did a mock oral argument about how not to do it based on a real case one of them had seen where the guy was just terrible, which was funny, but also extremely instructive. And so that we didn't really know if it was going to work, but we had a max number of people who could sign up. That number of people signed up. They came, we did it. We did it every year for a number of years. And then what was happening was everybody wanted to go was already going. And so we ultimately, at some point, they decided to alternate years. And then about that time, I got involved. I was doing something else. It was a big time commitment. And so that's when Celine and Steve agreed to take it over. And then they've been, you know, Celine especially, I think, and because she always works on the problem, have been running it since. But it's turned out to be a great program, and it's really appreciated. I think the best part of it is the judges really appreciated it. They said it was a great opportunity for them to work with young lawyers and get young lawyers doing it the right way so that they got a better product before their court. And I thought that was one of the best things I'd ever heard about the program.
I think one of the things that shows how valuable and how attractive that program was is the fact that you would get lawyers to come to it because it was such a commitment. I mean, I don't even know what it cost back in the day. It was you know, relatively expensive when I went, but it was the time commitment because you're asking lawyers to set aside their billable work and, you know, produce a sort of a, you know, sample brief, and then also to prepare for oral argument. Of course, there's some pressure because you're in front of judges, so you want to do a good job. So to get lawyers to, you know, commit that level of time and involvement just goes to show how impressive the program was.
Yeah, and judges, because if you recall, the judges got the briefs ahead of time and did critiques and wrote them, you know, and it wasn't just one. I mean, they passed them around, and they literally, most of them would, back in those were paper days, when I was involved, they'd sit down and redline the brief and write notes in the margins and do all that kind of stuff. They spent a lot of time doing those briefs. It wasn't just a look it over and give you a few comments. It was detailed feedback about how to do a better brief.
Yes, yes, definitely. Well, you know, I know that things have been derailed a little bit by COVID and all that sort of thing, and we're a little bit off track on that. But I suspect that that program is coming back, and I think you know, there will be a whole new audience of young lawyers who can and should attend.
Yeah, one of the interesting things, the anecdotes about that is when I was back working for the court, and it was quite a bit after I was no longer involved, but I went over, I think I went with the state court administrator, Lisa Goodner, Lisa Keel now. We went to meet with a legislator, and we walked in and meet with him, and, you know, I said, "Nice to meet you." And he goes, "Oh, we've met before." And I said, "When?" He says, I went to the appellate workshop. And I was like, he says, "Yeah, you were there running." And I didn't remember him at all, I hate to say, but he said it was one of the best CLEs I've ever been to in my life, you know? So that, I thought that was, and he didn't become an appellate lawyer. He just went because he wanted to learn to be a better writer and better speaker in front of judges. And he just thought that was a good way to do it, even though he wasn't an appellate lawyer.
Wow. So, yeah, that is a great testament to the CLE. I'm jumping forward a little bit, or maybe not. I guess it depends on what your answer is. But you know, the section I see has had a history of doing retreats and planning sessions going really all the way back. Not necessarily on the scale that the section has done more recently, In 2022, we actually did our first international retreat to London. You and I were both there. But if memory serves, you had been an advocate for trying an international venue for a long time, right. A long time before that. And where did that sort of desire come from?
I think part of it was, you know, once I became the clerk at the Supreme Court, I became active in the National Conference of Appellate Court Clerks, and that group meets every year somewhere. In fact, this year I'm going to their conference again because I can go as a retired clerk. This will be their 50th anniversary of having a week-long education session somewhere in the United States. And a few years ago, they invited clerks from Canada to join, and they have some Canadian clerks who belong to the organization, as well as clerks from Native American courts, which we had never included before, but realized there's a big appellate Native American law system in the United States. We don't see too much of that in Florida, although there is a lot of Native American law practiced in Florida. But one of the other groups that does that is the National Association of I can't think of the proper name for it. It's the person at most Supreme Courts, the reporter of decisions. It's the person who really reads the opinion, makes sure all the citation is correct, makes sure the grammar it fits the style guide that whatever that court has. And one year when the appellate clerks were somewhere, I think we were in Maryland that year, the reporter of decisions had their thing in London. And I thought, how cool is that? You know? So I tried to talk the clerks of court into it, and they wouldn't do it, partly because they didn't think their courts would fund them to go, because the courts have to fund them to go. They wouldn't do it. But it occurred to me, geez, why didn't the section do that? You know, because, and then I found out from talking to Judge Cope that lots of the sections had already done it. Appellate was kind of late to the party. So I just became interested in it. And as you know, my wife and I have had a bunch of foreign exchange students over the years, we became much more interested in the world as a whole. And we've traveled a lot, especially since I retired. And as you know, I'm doing this interview from Italy. I just became really interested, and I thought it would be a good chance for us to see those other courts and how they work. I have two close friends from law school, probably in the five best friends from law school. These two guys, I was on moot court and trial advocacy, every competition the University of Miami had with one of them. And they both are really active in going outside the United States and teaching how law works in the United States in other countries. And I thought appellate lawyers, you know, we're sort of up there where the law gets made. And I thought for appellate lawyers, it would be really good for us to just go see how it's done some other place. And the thing in England this year certainly proved that to be true. I mean, it's fascinating hearing how their court works there. I mean, some of it we know, but until you hear it from the actual people, it was totally different and really informative, really educational.
It was fantastic. And yeah, I think it was a very natural sort of progression. You know, the retreat before that was in Washington, D.C., which also made a lot of sense. And right. And we went to the U.S. Supreme Court and all that. But, you know, so much of our legal history and tradition comes from the UK, and right. to go over and to see, you know, British common law, where it was born,
right,
where it develops, I think was definitely a great perspective for any sort of lawyer, but certainly for appellate lawyers.
Yeah, I was struck by how the one judge said that they don't wear robes on the bench at the appellate courts, even though at the trial courts, as you know, they're really into the robes and the wigs, and they still do all that stuff. Where at the appellate court, they just wear a suit to court. so different.
Yeah. And in the UK Supreme Court, the bench is not even elevated. Right. The justices sit at the same level as the lawyers. And I thought that was really insightful into, you know, what they're trying to do there and how they're trying to modernize their court and how they're trying to portray it.
Right. Well, especially because my impression was their courts were sort of old and antiquated and still use the old language and stuff. And that just turned out to not be true.
Are there any other favorite moments that stand out in your mind over the years with the appellate practice section?
I don't know that it's certainly not a particular moment in time. I think the appellate practice section, and I think the trial lawyer section is like this too, but I think it's really ingrained in the appellate section, is we have people who literally litigate against each other every day. Because people tend to be on one side or other all the time for the most part, and they litigate against each other all the time. But yet when we're in those appellate section meetings, that just goes away. You wouldn't even know it. You'd think we all worked on the same side or something. I mean, it's just completely that way. It just permeates the section.
That is one of my favorite things about the section too, the collegiality, you know, and just sort of the team building. And I'm on a run of oral arguments against other board certified APS members. I'm up to two or three now in a row, and it's a fun experience, you know, to get together with your colleagues that you know so well and argue a case and do it right and do it professionally and do it courteously. That's one of my favorite things about the section too, is just the collegiality.
Yeah. And I tell this story in some CLEs, you know, the appellate courts noticed that, you know, Justice Anstead at a professionalism, seminar one year specifically said that one of the things he did was when the case was over, as soon as argument was over, he would always look up to see if the lawyer shook hands as they walked out. And he said it gave him a great feel for what those lawyers were like if they did.
Since we're talking about the history of the section, Tom, I would be remiss not to mention that you were a recipient of the section's highest honor, the James C. Adkins Award in 2007. The Adkins Award is one of the, again, I think one of the highlights of the annual meeting, and it's one of the great things that the section does is in recognizing people who have, you know, had a real impact on the appellate community. I know you're too modest to brag about that, but I wanted to mention it and say that your contributions to appellate practice, both to the section and to the state, are noted and appreciated, and it was a well-deserved award for you.
Well, I really appreciate that. None of us get involved because we're trying to win awards. That's not why we do it. And so it's the one place where you really do get honored by your peers. That was a really interesting thing. And the thing about that also is, when Justice Adkins passed away, the section gave him this award, unfortunately, posthumously, and I was very honored to be able to present that to his family at the ceremony that was held at the court, where we acknowledged that, and then I'm not 100% positive, I think that's where we decided that the award would then be named after him. That was part of that process. And so that was really kind of a big honor to be able to present that and then thank his family for all he had done for the section and for, you know, just appellate practice in general.
That's one of the things about namesake awards like that is I never had the opportunity to meet him and have no, you know, sort of recollection. His name and reputation lives on through that award. And I think that that's exactly what the award is intended to do and to be so meaningful for the people who receive it after. So that's exactly what the award was intended to do. And that's what it does.
Yeah. Yeah. And it is a, you know, if you look at that list, there's some great people on the list, people who've done a lot more than I have. I think one of the other highlights that I remember was just when we had things happen where, oh my gosh, this is going on or that is going on. And this happens, as you know, all the time. There's some sort of a problem and the chair will say, I need some people to help. And boom, there's never people sitting on their hands. It's like you almost always end up with more people than you need to do it. I belong to government lawyer. I belong to real property probate. I have a small firm. I belong to all those. I think appellate is better at that than any of those other sections. And those are all great sections. They really are. But that appellate is just really great at that.
And it has been that way as long as I have been involved. And it sounds like as long as the section has been in existence, and we have to hope that we can maintain that, sort of mindset going forward, because that is important and it's something that makes us special.
And how many former chairs stay active? You know, we have the opt-in. You can say, yeah, I'd like to continue on the section as the former chair. There's a lot. I mean, and compared to other sections, I don't know every section, but compared to other sections, I think we have a lot more of that than the other sections do.
Well, Tom, there's so much to cover in this history project and so many folks that played an important role in what the section has become that we can only hope to scratch the surface. But I really appreciate you taking the time all the way from Italy and sharing some of your memories for this project.
Well, it was my pleasure, and I always enjoy it.
Thanks, Tom.
Thank you.
This oral history project was commissioned by the Appellate Practice Section in 2023 to record the history of the section as part of its 30th anniversary. Thank you for listening.